Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
I am Carolyn De La Pena. I am an American Studies professor. I'm the director of the UC Davis Humanities Institute, and we partner with the Council on a number of projects, engaged projects, and it's a real pleasure to be here with our panelists today. You are in Strand 1, the first session, called An Informed Society. We're going to be looking across the next few hours because both this session and then the one that will follow it, although looking at slightly different aspects, are focusing on this same general issue, at the relationship between a healthy democracy and an informed citizenry and what we mean by informed citizenry and how we might achieve that. So our panel will be looking at history, but also at the present, and how we access the information that we need to participate actively and with good outcome in a democratic society. And our focus will be on public education, specifically civics and civic education, public libraries, and the media, especially as it provides access to political knowledge, news, information. On the format, I will open up the conversation with our speakers with some questions that I have for them. I've had the opportunity to talk with them before now. And we'll leave a lot of time for questions. I assume in the audience are people with expertise on this issue. The panelists also assume that. And we're really looking forward to hearing your point of view as well on these issues. Because we are webcasted simultaneously, I will have to repeat your questions. So if you could, when you ask the question, make sure that you do it in a way that it's not too hard on me, that I can repeat it succinctly without getting it wrong. If I get it wrong, tell me. So I just want to say a word about me and why I might be moderating this session. I am also the co-editor of, along with Louis Warren, of this, which is called Boom, a Journal of California, and it's I'm very pleased with it. It's from UC Press, and it's just coming out this month. So I'm going to put the couple copies I have out at the information table so you could take a peek at it if you want to. And we have several of the people who've worked with us on Boom here in this conversation today, and I don't think that that's just a coincidence. Mark Paul is in this issue. George Sanchez is on our editorial board. Daniel Hosang has a piece in here. So the project that I've been doing along with UC Press and Louis Warren has really been to try to create a new space where journalists and academics can come together on issues of California politics and culture. For me, my particular commitment to this is as an academic, where I think often we write in very specialized forums and we write for people who sort of know what we know. And we don't often get an opportunity to share our expertise with the public. And I also think between journalists and academics, there are very important lessons there about writing skills, writing research, and how we think about information. So we've been working really hard on this for 2 years. And what I've come to believe is that the primary question that confronts us right now is, as academics, especially in a public university like the University of California, is how do we produce useful knowledge and how do we do that in dialogue with informed citizens? How do we think of ourselves as citizens when we make decisions about what knowledge we choose to produce as academics? So I'm very excited to be here today working on this general question with all of you. The goal that I think I would say we have for this session is, you know, obviously we want you to know more about the specific areas than maybe you did when you came in, but I also think we want to look at these structures that provide opportunities for us to be informed about democracy and to think about how they work across sort of the lifespan and the relationship between structures that provide information and choices that we make as we seek information throughout our lives. And many of the questions that I hope to elicit and that I think will come out of the discussion is, where do these institutions come from? Why these institutions over others? What do they do when they work well? What are the limitations? And I think, importantly, what do we mean when we say informed? What does that word mean? What is the goal? And is an informed society, does that mean everyone is informed? are certain people more important to inform or their information to be public and presented than others? I'm going to start out by introducing our speakers, and then I'll pose a couple questions. Our first speaker, it's not speaker, panelist, Beverly Lynch. Beverly is the author of 4 books and a number of articles. She's a professor of education and information studies. She's the director of the UCLA Senior Fellows Program and the California Rare Book School. She's served as the executive secretary of the Association of College and Research Libraries and university librarian and professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She teaches in the areas of library management, academic libraries and systems of higher education, intellectual freedom, and measurement and evaluation. Thanks for being with us, Beverly. Our second panelist is Lisa Garcia Bedoya. Dr. Bedoya is the author of 3 books, a number of articles. She's also professor of education and political science and chair of the Center for Latino Policy and Research at UC Berkeley. Her research interests center around the civic engagement, community activity, and political incorporation of racial and ethnic groups in the U.S. And her recent projects include a historical study of group citizenship status in California during the 19th century, an evaluation of voter mobilization strategies by community-based organizations in Southern California and the Central Valley, and a longitudinal study of the political socialization of immigrant youth in Orange County. And our last panelist is Tom Houlihan. Tom's the author of 4 books, most recently Uncivil Wars, Political Campaigns in a Media Age, and a number of articles. He's a professor of communication at the USC Annenberg School, and he publishes in the areas of argumentation, political campaign communication, contemporary rhetorical criticism, and the impact of globalization on political deliberation. He has also served as the chairperson of the Board of Trustees for the National Debate Tournament, and maybe he wants to take on the question of the difference between debate and discussion that came up earlier. Maybe not. So let's go ahead and get started. And I want to begin with Beverly and ask you to talk a little bit about libraries, and specifically, what was the impetus for libraries? Where did they come from? What were they supposed to achieve? And thinking through that relationship to information and informed citizenship.
Now you're talking about public libraries.
Correct,
right? Because
public
I could talk
libraries.
A lot about academic libraries.
Yeah,
well.
Let's talk about public libraries
okay.
First.
It's a particularly and peculiarly American design, and it's unlike anything else in the world. And really, you have to look at it from the founders and the founding of the country, where there were no books and there was no printing and there was nothing. But the people coming here brought books with them and felt that they had to have a citizenry that could read. And they also wanted books, and they couldn't afford them, so they pooled their monies together. And Ben Franklin and his group founded a reading society where they all put their money in and then they circulated the books among them. So there were predecessors or precursors, if you will, of the public library. It was really after the 2 English wars, Revolution and War of 1812, that the country then began to be, first of all, interested in education, and they wanted an educated citizenry. And so there was a groundswell to develop local schools and to enable people to go to school till they were 16 or so. But there also then was an interest in a public library, and that was a library that was designated by state legislature, allowed into the community, that tax monies were determined to fund it, and that it was open to all. There was no class distinction. So the factory owner and the factory worker had equal access. And those 3 characteristics continue to this day. And so the fact that it was founded in law, that it was tax-based, open to all, was the base of the public library. And we have nearly 10,000 public libraries in the United States now, and like 16 or 17,000 if you count the branches. But administrative units about 10,000, a little under 10,000. And they're very well, maybe not financially as well supported as they would like, but the communities really respect, admire, and use the public library. And the collections are not biased. That is, all points of view are represented. The boards don't tell the public library director what to buy. It's a professional selection policy. There are extraordinary after-school educational programs for kids, and that's a big component of many of the public libraries. It's a very well assimilated into, I think, American society.
Can you just talk a little bit about, for those who established the initial public libraries in this period, what made it so important to have information provided from multiple points of view? And here I'm just thinking around, what was the problem that individuals were attempting to solve? What was the idea of what libraries would do when they worked well?
There were a number of motives, but of course an educated electorate was one of them. And the founders and the people coming after them were concerned that the founders and their points of view might be lost if there weren't a place to have that kind of information. So that was one motivation. Another motivation was to enable some kind of an adult education program for people who didn't have any education beyond their schooling of up to 16. What would they do after that? No money. Where would they get materials to read? So that was another motivation.
Yeah, Lisa, can I ask you to talk with us in light of that, especially around this being a uniquely American institution that was established and the emphasis on different points of view, how you would then frame the same sort of question about civics and civics education, thinking through where did the model of civics education come from that we have? And if you could just briefly, for those of us that don't know, when we say civics, what do we mean?
That's an excellent question. I don't think there's an easy answer. Civics education has always had a tension between, on the one hand, creating an informed citizenry, which is something that Jefferson talked about and other of the founders, the idea that to have a democracy, you needed to have an educated set of citizens that could then engage in informed decision-making. On the other hand, civics is also about creating senses of national pride and national identity and patriotism. And sometimes those things are at odds with one another, in particular for communities who were not included in that definition of citizen. And for the majority of American history, that was women and people of color, and for some period of time, folks without property. And so on some level, the public library is a more perfect, I think, example of the expression of that idea of equal access than civic education. Civic education has been has a much more kind of bumpy history in terms of its ability to create an idea of an inclusive citizenry that really does speak to and include all members of the American polity.
And so civics education, like we would experience it or might remember it from our own schooling.
Forget.
Which part of our school experience was civics education?
So if you grew up in the state of California, in fifth grade, you had U.S. government, and in 12th grade, you had U.S. government. Now you might have government and economics. They've split it in half. You can kind of count California history in fourth grade, and you get a little bit of local government in second and third grade, but really the idea of government, civics, is in those two, the fifth and 12th grade social science, and or social studies, sorry, curriculum.
And the goal behind that sort of curriculum, how would you phrase that?
So I think the way that we teach civics is from an institutional perspective. We talk about how the institutions were created. We talk about the founders. There's an implication that the founders were brilliant, that the Constitution is perfect, that there's checks and balances, that all the different branches of government know what they're supposed to do and they operate very well, and you really don't have to worry about it very much. There are these institutions, and it's really largely at the national level. There isn't a tremendous amount of information that you get in the public school curriculum officially, while other teachers can supplement and whatnot, but on the function of local government, for example, what a city council person does, what a school board member does, that kind of information, generally speaking, is not really part of the curriculum, even though those are the people that actually have the most direct impact on people's lives in many cases, much more so than the national level government.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, where would you place media in all of this?
Well, media plays an important role, but I would like to take the liberty of quickly following up on two things my colleagues have said. First, the comment Beverly makes about libraries and their critical role in what's happening with budgets. Libraries now aren't just about books or newspapers. They're also the places where people are accessing new technologies. And for people who don't have access to the internet at home or don't have broadband access, libraries play a critical role. You can't even apply for a job if you can't be online. And we're hammering budgets for libraries. They may be the most heavily used sites for public civic spaces, and yet they're woefully underfunded. In the city of L.A., libraries are now closed on Sundays and Mondays, which happens to be, you know, Sunday is a day that people could actually go there, and we don't have the money to keep them open.
That was Proposition L.
Hopefully. We're all holding our hopes for that one. On the issue of civics education, I would just add that Every morning from grade school on, we get kids up to say the Pledge of Allegiance, which is essentially a civic prayer. It is a ritualized sort of behavior. And so civics education isn't just sort of learning the formal history. It's also inculcating a set of values that I think Lisa does a wonderful job of explaining become infused as part of the identity of a culture. And what it is to be an American is a part of an experience that we all recall from the way those stories, those narratives are given to us about the founding fathers, the principles under which our democracy was created. People learn about politics primarily from their parents. We're shaped most importantly by the values of our parents. If you want to understand how a community is going to vote, poll the grade school, and you're going to get a more accurate polling than you're going to get almost anywhere else, because the grade school is really going to reflect the values very much of the parents. Beyond the parents, the schools, religious communities are the places where people acquire political values. Once you get past those things, then media is the place where we get the material knowledge to understand the world we live in and to make wise political choices. The media transforms the immediacy of my experience, what I understand to be the conditions in the world that I inhabit, and helps me compare those to the experiences of others. It takes the raw facts of daily life and transforms them into constructed news narratives that help me understand the world. When we use a common source of media, we're much more likely to engage in a common and shared conversation. When we segment our audience and fragment our media sources and go to media sources that, as the morning panel said, essentially confirm what we already believe to be true because we're following them either on online sites that are people writing of a like mind or in cable news outlets that are people telling a story of a like mind, then we get a very different kind of news experience and we change fundamentally the way people acquire information that they're going to use to make their political decisions.
So if I could ask you to maybe expand a little bit on that, Tom, and then I will open it back up. Something that you had mentioned earlier that's come, in my mind, I think of it as sort of the water cooler commons concept. If you could talk a little bit about that to help sort of solidify this notion of how much information does one need or what's the extent of the information you can have to be informed?
There are a lot of different theories about how and why people attend to media, but one of the best theories, although it may not be the most powerfully explanatory theory, says that we go to the media to seek information that we either have an immediate need for or information that we find amusing in some way. It entertains us and it pleases us. If I'm going to go on a picnic tomorrow, I'm going to check the weather forecast. Or if there's an earthquake in Southern California, I'm quickly going to go to the media to see where it was and if what I experienced was more or less what my fellow citizens experienced. Or we'll go to the media simply to be titillated. And, you know, nothing like a good sex scandal with a famous person in order to drive media coverage. We claim to hate that sort of stuff while we watch it enthusiastically. One thing about media conversation, though, is one function of media use is that we feel a need to contribute to the conversation the next day. Whether it's at work or at school or at play, we need to be informed. And the kind of classic study of this is in the 1950s when Israel moves from one television network to two television networks. And they expect with two television networks, both doing a national newscast, that the audience for the national news will actually increase because people could watch it either at 9 o'clock o'clock or at 10 o'clock. What they found, in fact, was the audience on both channels, the total news audience, actually shrunk. And it shrunk because people could then make the excuse that, oh, I missed that story on TVA. I must have been watching TVB. They didn't have that same sort of responsibility that they had to be a part of the conversation. And, of course, now on my DirecTV station, I have 500 channels. You can get all cooking, all gardening, all sports, all movies. Regardless of what you want, you can be totally news-averse if you wish to be news-averse. And sadly, I think we have people who aren't contributing to that common conversation because they're not watching news. They may be essentially unnewsed.
And I wonder, Lisa and Beverly, if you want to respond to that, considering the way that those general concepts from media also might relate to the question of civic education or around public libraries, or if you see differences there.
I mean, I think it's important to think about what kinds of information people get and then how different communities of people get information. So like one thing, for example, while it's true that studies have shown that people get their political values and affiliations from their parents, in immigrant communities, studies suggest that actually parents get it from their children because it's going in a different direction. Because kids are the translation, serve that translation function between the home language and the language of the United States. So the other issue is then where are people getting their media information? And so we have, you know, ethnic media that tells different stories, has stories from different perspectives, and stories that create a different set of values for different communities that then have an impact on how people see politics. And so, for example, studies of English language coverage of immigration and Spanish language coverage of immigration shows in English language coverage you're much less likely, for example, to see kind of the human costs of what happens with deportation and what happens, right? And so you get a different attitude towards a policy issue that affects both people, but different perspectives. And so in terms of information, as we have, you know, more and more information, you also have bifurcations in terms of the type of access to information about communities that are different from ours, because of not only ideology, but also race and class. And I think that's something that then affects what we know about the government, how we see government policies, and then also just the fact that you don't get, generally speaking, like in a media market like the LA, which is so big, if there's a local race, you know nothing about the people who are running. You know nothing about their background. They don't get covered in the local media. And so you really have to go out and find that information. And that, again, is much easier for people with more resources or people who are more tied in or people who are identified, like the gentleman said this morning, who are identified as likely voters, right? Those are the people who are then going to get political information, not the general population. And so there are a lot of problems with different kinds of information for different kinds of people and how that ends up maintaining stratification within society in politics.
I generally have an attitude about what I read in the media, and you can just think about what that attitude is. But the extraordinary Supreme Court case this week, I think, is a masterful civics lesson and inspires people. And even though this is when the funeral was picketed and Justice Roberts wrote the majority opinion saying, as much as I personally detest the opinion I'm giving or what really happened there, this indeed was a First Amendment free speech issue that we must allow in under our laws. That has generated more conversation in 24 hours for me than anything else in the last month, practically, because you have to talk about how we've expanded our definition of speech, how we've expanded our interpretation of the First Amendment, and what this country is all about. Things you really detest under the rule of law, you have to continue to support. That's just fantastic civics, actually. And the media has covered that whole case, I think, better than any that they've done in a long time. But that probably is not answering your question, but I'm excited about this.
No, that's good. And I want to push you a little bit to connect that with some of the specifics of libraries, of public libraries. Because one of the things that we've talked about that I think is fascinating is who uses the library, who's in the library, what kinds of information are people craving in library use. And I think it's interesting to think about that in relation to other forms of information around media and civic education. So can you frame for us a little bit the typical library user now and what the library user wants from the
I'm
library?
Not an expert on that, and there are people in this audience who really are. But let me just comment from the earliest days. You remember, we're a country of immigrants. And in less than 100 years, we went from 3 million to 38 million. That's immigration. That's not birth. And the library at that time and now was designed to service those immigrant populations. And public libraries have worked very hard to do that. And also to, and we've got many pockets of immigration serviced by public libraries in this city. And those public libraries, once they've identified that a population change has occurred, they work to identify the language, find materials in that language, and add those to their collection. So that's one. Immigrant populations have been an extraordinary service that to that community that public libraries have done. Seniors. People that Tom talks about who have no opportunity for the new technology. The interesting thing about the public library that we should emphasize is that no one has to explain to anybody what they're looking for or why. You can find it yourself, or you can say, I'm looking for something on, and the librarian doesn't say, and who are you and why do you want to know that? I mean, it's really an extraordinary service that the community provides to its citizens and others. I think that anonymity is a very important issue.
So to follow up on something I kind of heard across the comments, how do you think about the relationship between information and effective democracy? And here what I'm pushing on is thinking through, it's almost like a kind of a distinction between what Tom's talking about and what Lisa's talking about, through that we want to have a sort of limited number of outlets or media outlets, and correct me if I'm wrong, but that we need to have a common conversation somehow. And yet, in civics education, a common conversation sounds to me like it's not doing something, or it's not the right kind of common as you're thinking through it, Lisa. And so can you talk a little bit about what information does to produce what you see as sort of an effective democracy?
So I guess to begin with how we teach civics, for me I'd make a distinction between what we do, which is I think sort of an institutional fact-based approach to a problem-solving approach. And so if you introduce students to politics by saying politics is the way in which we solve collective problems, right, solve problems that are beyond me as an individual, then a civics class would really be about identifying those problems and thinking about the ways in which government can and cannot arrive at those solutions for you. And so let's say if you did in your fifth grade government and you think that you needed a stop sign on your corner, that you would go as a class and you would figure out who in the city government is responsible for that. How do you go about petitioning for that? What kind of justification do you need for that? So that then you come up with a civics then also, though, that has the analytical side of learning to interpret political information and thinking about the ways in which different policies affect you. And I think if we were to learn those kinds of things in school of really teaching students to be able to feel like they are empowered actors, that when they run into problems in their lives, that they would have the ability to solve those problems or to join with other people in order to figure out how to solve those problems, rather than now, which is basically saying, it's fine. We don't teach people how to access the levers of power. And so what ends up happening is individuals who happen to be raised in families who already have those connections or have those understandings get that information from their parents. But if you come from a family that doesn't have that background, you have no way of knowing that. And so people feel alienated and disempowered when they do confront problems in their lives. And so it's not that people were talking about what engages people. People don't engage on a trajectory, right? People kind of ebb and flow in and out of the political system. It's really a question of the degree to which you see the political system as something you understand and can access. And in that way, I think then, if you get political information later in your life, you're able to kind of assess the veracity of that information, the quality of that information. If you've got a state governor who's talking about immigration policy, perhaps you would know that that's not her responsibility. Things like that, that now we don't, really. And I think a lot of it has to do with the foundation that we get is not an active foundation, it's a passive foundation. And I think if we create political actors, by definition, we may not need a common story, but we'll at least have better consumers of information.
Yeah, Tom.
I don't want to be defending fewer sources of information. I mean, I think one of the blessings of the moment is that we have multiple sources. What we actually have is a widening rich-poor information gap. Those who want great information can get it. I mean, I can read about what's happening in the Middle East by going to English language editions of newspapers all over the world and not be limited to just U.S. news sources. So I think that can be great. But I do think we want some common touchstones of conversation. We don't want to only be reading the sources of news that confirm what we already believe to be the case, which I think, unfortunately, many people are today. The other thing I would say is Lisa is spot on when she says we need civics education so that people can learn how to exercise the resources that are available to them in their government. They know how to serve on a jury. They know what their civic responsibilities are. They understand the concept of innocent till proven guilty. They deal with issues about the First Amendment or the core values of our country. We need a kind of information that helps citizens make wise decisions about what kinds of political choices are in their own personal best interests. In the morning panel, the gentleman who heads the Republican Party emphasized a politics of self-interest, and I don't disagree with the importance of helping voters make wise self-interest. More importantly, though, I would submit, is we need a kind of information and a kind of civic education that helps us identify our collective interests, that helps us recognize our connections and commitments to each other. Because those are the kinds of political instruction, and that is the kind of political information that helps us recognize our bonds as a nation and as a people of shared commitment. That is a nation that makes us sympathetic to those who suffer from poverty or who suffer the affliction of disease or who may face the challenges of a natural disaster, even though we may ourselves be warm, healthy, and dry. And that's the kind of civics education that I think is really critical, and that's a function that media helps play for us as well.
And Beverly, is there something that libraries can show us or teach us in this? And I'm thinking that the fact that libraries are locally controlled and the fact that libraries have been these very important spaces of multiple perspectives on issues and that immigrants have repeatedly found in libraries important tools for engagement. Is there something in libraries that we could appreciate more in thinking about these issues?
Well, I think anything as important, in my view, as the local public library and its design always can be attacked. And so you certainly want to continue to show support at the local government level. And that's, you know, as Lisa says, it's local government that is not really emphasized as much as it should be. It's easier to talk about Washington when you're in California than it is to talk about California when you're in California. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. And so I think the knowledge and understanding of the organization, local government, what kind of boards the public library has, what role the mayor plays, what role private foundations and strong supporters who believe in the public library play in terms of funding, all of those are local issues that we probably that support the concept of the local public library, but are not taught anywhere, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think the structure of the local public library is solid, but it's always you're as strong as your weakest link. Yeah.
Something else I wanted to ask about is the question of the local and how important the local is in your thinking through, you know, what creates a vibrant democracy. And if you could talk a little bit more about the local, something that Beverly and I talked about earlier was the fact that for a lot of immigrants who come in to use library resources, many times what they're connecting to is information from their home country. And in a sense, the democratic processes they might be engaging in, while local in that it's happening in the library, are in a sense kind of global. And I wonder how you think about that too, Lisa, around this question of, especially that it's important for immigrant communities to engage on kind of a local level through questions of school board and how things get done. But does it also sort of push us to think more about these distinctions we make between local and global, or that American democracy is what we're trying to achieve as opposed to maybe information flow and connection to community?
Right. I mean, I think they're not mutually exclusive. There haven't been a lot of good studies on transnational political engagement, but there's a suggestion that it's not mutually exclusive. If you're engaged in your home country, you're also engaged here. It's not that you choose one over the other. And in fact, the reality is very few immigrants are engaged in their home country, but those that are also engaged here. I think thinking about the local is important on a number of levels. I think if you're going to teach kids about how to solve problems, you really do have to talk about problems that are rooted in their lived experience in their daily lives, which is their local community, and then really think about that community as a collective with similar interests, and how do we think about resolving those interests. And I think, especially in a state like California, where you have to integrate many immigrants into our society in a substantive way, thinking about politics in that way moves us away from these sort of arbitrary distinctions between citizens and non-citizens. When, you know, if we're all living in a neighborhood and there's a toxic waste dump, it's affecting all of us, regardless of our migration status. Additionally, you have communities in California where you have a majority of the adult population who's non-citizen and therefore can't vote. And so what does that mean for democratic legitimacy if the representatives are not chosen by the majority of the population? The state of California, over half of the student population right now is Latino. Mm-hmm. At least half of those are of immigrant parents. So again, you really have to think about how do we integrate all of our citizens into the decision-making process and really think about politics as about that, about solving all of our collective problems, because we're all in this together, instead of creating these divisions that are artificial and not very helpful in terms of moving everyone's well-being forward in society.
Yeah. Tom,
we have a special problem in Los Angeles because of the crazy quilt of communities that define the basin and the adjoining neighborhoods. And I was doing some work elections past with candidates for mayor of L.A. as well as candidates for the County Board of Supervisors. And our polling data was coming back that large numbers of people who were registered to vote honestly didn't know if they lived in the city. You would move across L.A. from community to community, communities with their own defined area names, and people didn't know if they lived in the city or if they lived in an unincorporated part of the county. I mean, that's an amazing thing to be able to say. And in an area where people still claim they get most of their news from local television news, you know how little attention local television news ever gives to local politics. The city of L.A. politics may be mentioned a bit, but only one in eight in the major media market, only one person in this media market out of eight can vote in an L.A. city election. If you live in Alhambra, if you live in Bell, look what happened there because we had no local media covering local politics. People are really, really not getting information about local news. So one of the things the Annenberg School, in a project directed by one of my colleagues, is doing is trying to look at micro local news sources, taking Alhambra, which is a very interesting community, which over the past 30 years has moved from predominantly white to largely Hispanic and now predominantly Asian, with a great sort of transformation of population, to try to see what kind of local engine of news production, alternative forms of media, alternative forms of civic engagement might be created to help foster and improve knowledge about local issues. Because I think it's a huge problem here. And it's not just immigrant communities that don't know about their local news. The circulation of local newspapers, you know, papers in Long Beach and in Pasadena and in Riverside that used to supply people with a good deal of local news, those papers are really, really hurting nowadays. And in many cases, they have virtually no news staffs anymore. I mean, if you read those papers, they have one or two beat reporters, and most of the stories that they're working on are local high school sports.
So I'd like at this point to open it up to questions. If we have questions, it would be great to get the audience involved in the dialogue. So to say that question, because that's my job, I have to say the question over again. Susan wants to know, how do adults who need it get the basic scaffolding information that is required in order to understand the political issues at stake And Lisa, we can answer.
You know, we talked about this on the forum. Unfortunately, I don't have a good answer. One of the reasons I want to start in schools is that that's where we have a captive audience. I think asking adults to learn about politics would be, you'd have to provide a huge monetary incentive for them to even sign up for such a thing. You do have citizenship classes for immigrants, and you could make those much more substantive than they are now. But again, I think it would be difficult to think of what kind of a space you could create that folks would participate in, that they would have the time to engage in, to actually learn about all these different components. I don't know if you guys...
Tom, yeah.
This isn't exactly responsive to the scaffolding notion, but one sort of exciting, interesting innovation that I've been a part of is setting up kiosks, literally information kiosks, using interactive technologies where at the airport or at supermarkets or, you know, when you're waiting at the DMV or places like that, people have time, extra time, they can actually engage. And indeed, this idea, as it's playing out, also allows them to state their opinions and then hear the opinions of others and literally have debates, computer-assisted, constructed, argumentative exchanges with people who may have different opinions than themselves on local issues as a way to sort of facilitate engagement of various kinds. So, you know, I don't present that as the only model, but I think we have to begin to think about new frames for how the information can be presented and new forms and opportunities. In the 1950s and early 1960s, there was this incredible optimism that, you know, public television was going to play this. And maybe it did. Like when I was a kid, there were so few alternatives to watch. I watched those kind of programs. But now, of course, the audience for local cable access or for those kinds of educational programs, I think, is minuscule. So I don't think pushing them out through traditional forms of media is likely to work. You know, the key to make people get information, I said, is you either got to convince them they need it or convince them they want it. And you got to make it fun. You got to make it enjoyable if you can't make it necessary.
I mean, another entity that can do this work would be community organizations. And one way to think about it, you know, many foundations fund electoral work around elections. And so if foundations saw it as necessary to fund those organizations to do voter education work between elections and to see that as part of the community building that is then necessary to turn people out, I mean, that would be another space. And there are organizations that do this work, but if it were more explicit, getting the idea that politics is about in between elections as well as
there's a comment.
It may be that you have posed the problem in a way that nobody's ever thought about it. You know, some of the most profound ideas come just like this, and it may be that it could emerge as a very important, if not national, local policy development issue that people could gather around and find solutions to. I mean, if we had ground-based data that says how few people know anything about their local government, step one.
We do
step
have
two,
that data.
Then
we know people know almost nothing.
There are people in virtual gaming, by the way,
yeah,
that are focused on games, learning device games, to teach that kind of political engagement.
And we have a comment from the audience. I think some wisdom is out there waiting for us right now here. Yes, who are you? So the question is, can you talk about what occurred after 9/11 with libraries and required lists about who was checking out what book, and comment on where that fits with some of the other things that we've heard about libraries and democratic access.
The Patriot Act was one of the major outcomes of the 9/11, and that has been overturned. The American Library Association has a very active program fighting all of these kinds of efforts to curtail information or to make you not as autonomous or unknown as you were. But we continue to fight that for all the right reasons. I mean, there are two points of view here. You know, there's the personal and government and country safety issues that have to be acknowledged, as well as the personal and private issues that have to be acknowledged. And they do come into conflict at some time, and so then you have to find the balance, and that's what's going on. But the Patriot Act was the tough one.
But this is one of those things that you've talked about, Beverly, that having access to information is essential, but having anonymous access to information is also, that is one of the foundational principles of the library. And what is it that you think makes that so essential?
It protects the person. government can't get at you. You know, you always have to protect yourself from government. That's what this question was. That's what the founders were worried about, and we have to continue to worry about that. That's, you know, be forever vigilant.
Thanks. Other questions?
So right.
Margaret's very nuanced question, restated by me, is going to sound like. Lisa talked about the government, understanding the government as a sort of through collective means, that's the sort of could be a pedagogical function of how we think about civics, and is there a tension between the role of the importance of the individual and then having these approaches that are much more emphasizing the collective?
I think the tension is overstated whenever people don't want the collective to benefit. The individual gets privileged at times when that undermines the collective solution in many cases. I mean, the reality is we would all die if we were rugged individuals. Human beings don't live in isolation. We go crazy when we live in isolation. So the fact of the matter is we're social beings. And given that we're social beings, we have to then take into consideration other social beings with whom we interact on a daily basis. And I think it would be better for all of us as individuals if, in fact, we took better care of the collective. And I think we don't have that conversation because we live in an era of growing inequality, and there are individuals and collectives in our society that benefit from the current emphasis on individual outcomes. And I think if we focused more on everyone, in fact, we would come up with a different sort of politics. So I think the rhetoric is not benign. It serves a political function. And I think that tension is overstated for political reasons rather than any sort of deep philosophical reason.
There were several questions right in here. Does someone else want to ask a question that wanted to a minute ago? Yes, back there. So Nancy's question is how it's worse. It's worse than this. So how in the world can you account for, I mean, what hope is there given when we throw testing in and the fact that many of the people who mostly need to understand and have these tools have dropped out for certainly related reasons by the 10th grade, and we only do this sort of civics in a tiny bit of 12th grade. Give her some hope.
Well, I think it's unfair to put it on teachers, frankly. I mean, I think it's but I mean, like, advice to give to teachers.
Right.
I mean, there are, so for example, I mean, I tried, it's not a perfect, I don't want to sort of plug, so Project Citizen is a curriculum that is not perfect, but it's a problem-based curriculum. It's for eighth graders. It's already established, it exists, you don't have to do anything. The idea is you bring college students in, you break students into groups, they identify problems in their community, and it can be as long as you want, 10 weeks or a semester, depending on how you work it. When I've tried to get teachers to implement this with my college students, many of them cited the same problems, that they need to work on, that, you know, that any day, they can't give up any day. So I guess one way to think about what you would tell teachers would be that maybe in other aspects of the curriculum to start asking students to make those connections in their lives. So maybe if you're studying other subject matters, if you think about science policy, you know, all the things that sort of aren't theoretically related to government, in fact, are affected by government. And so perhaps that kind of problem-based approach, incorporating it into other lessons, rather than saying it has to be a standalone civics lesson, perhaps is one way to approach it. But it seems to me simultaneously we as a society have to have a broader conversation about what kind of education are we providing students and what do we expect them to be capable of at the end. And I think the current testing environment really does move us in a direction that's deeply problematic on a number of levels in terms of the kinds of analytical thinking we're asking of students. And so it strikes me that both things simultaneously, you know, teachers always have kind of worked around the margins and done basically heroic things in the midst of all of the politics that surround their jobs. And I just don't want, you know, to say that it's just teachers have to do this. I think teachers can do what they can, and then we need to, as a society, help teachers be able to provide this kind of education to their students.
So Tom wants to come in here too, and I'm glad, because I'm sure he's going to tell us that the media can be a wonderful place where this can occur even after school.
Actually, what I was going to say is activity-based learning is really critical. Send them into their neighborhoods to conduct opinion polls of their neighbors on what they think the most vexing local community issues are. Have them assigned to develop their own position papers and conduct debates, classroom debates and exercises on ongoing controversies. You can't engage students by just having them read boring books about the past. you need to involve them in what's happening in the moment, and I think you'll have much better success.
Right. At least that was what I was saying. What I was saying is that there's not very much time.
Right. Yeah, I understand.
You're allowed to be teaching it at all.
Well, I understand, but I also would echo what Lisa was saying, is that when you're teaching science, you can talk about the issues of science in a policy-implicated sort of way. So look creatively at ways to teach across subject matter, and I realize it's challenging. I want to add just one more thing. In the morning panel, Professor Jameson made the very interesting observation that, you know, political participation is about where it is, but we might have expected it to increase because we have more college-educated people today. There's actually some recent studies that says political knowledge decreases after high school, despite going to college. So few colleges do a good job of teaching civics education. So few general education requirements are engaging students in thinking about politics that most students can go to a university and not attend to political issues or not be politically engaged. So again, as Lisa said, I don't think it's just teachers that are responsible. I think we have a collective responsibility, and it's a failure of parents to have engaged. It's a failure of the educational system to have created enough space and enough enthusiasm for innovative curriculum alternatives to teach some of this subject matter. And again, it's a failure of media to tell these stories in ways that make them exciting and interesting so that people will want to be attuned to them.
Other questions? David's opinion and David's question combined are thinking through Measure L. And if you have major media sources that are, in fact, coming out against an issue that one would think is foundational to some of the values of media in general around information access, what do we do then?
Well, one of the blessings of the new technology era is that you can become a producer of your own news. You can network with your colleagues. You can exchange information through your work and personal and professional networks. You can use Facebook and other forms of social networking sites. Clearly, you can write to the LA Times. You know, I think that editorial board has been a little curious recently myself. But any newspaper that continues to offer space to some of their columnists, despite some of the idiocy that they write, one has to be suspicious of. You know, that's the health of a vibrant democracy, I guess, is that we have opportunities to disagree with our media sources.
But I also think it's a symptom of a broader problem in our political discourse, and I'm not entirely sure how to solve this, but I feel like this economic downturn, rather than causing us to really think about and focus on the individuals who are responsible for it, have led to this like shrinking sense of public goods, and that somehow there's no voice for the idea that we need to invest in these areas for all of our benefit. And so I'm not sure how you start that, but it strikes me they are a reflection, right, of a broader discussion. If you think about what's going on in Wisconsin, if you think about the cuts to higher education and K-12 education, and the idea that this is where the money needs to come from, despite the fact that these entities had nothing to do with creating the mess that we're in.
You mean it wasn't teachers?
You know, I guess somehow that narrative is won, and I think all of us need to talk to our friends and do all these things in order to reframe what's going on, and the idea that despite the economic downturn, you know, the idea that what's going on, that what Governor Brown wants is a tax hike, you know, the stuff this morning from this morning's panel, is just really thinking about what does it mean for our society that we're not investing in any of these foundational elements to democracy.
I thought it was a brilliant move that Martin Gomez and his colleagues have put together in terms of Proposition L. There's, I've had at least three mailings directly to my home in support of the proposition or the measure. I don't know why. I haven't read the Daily News is another one that's gone against it. So the three major media sources that have gone against this. And I haven't read why, what their rationale is. But it fundamentally is not a tax increase. It's just shifting where certain funds of money can go. And so it's probably taking money away from things that the newspapers don't really want.
Yeah, I think the rationale is they're anxious about voter initiatives of various kinds that tie the hands of Sacramento legislators or of the governor. Mm-hmm. And whether those
doing
are
such a fine job.
Whether those are educational programs, library programs, health programs. I think that's the general anxiety. So I think it's on that issue, as opposed to opposition about libraries gaining more resources, mm-hmm. that the prime motivation lies.
Yes. So yeah, then we've talked around the question of how are you informed, but does anyone want to take on that question? There are of the layers in information, and maybe Tom wants to say something. We've talked a little bit about media literacy and that there's got to be some instruction in how to read the news, that reading the news is not necessarily enough, or clicking the news to the news to the news, but something beyond that has to be in place.
Well, one of the challenges we're facing in the new media era is that a lot of people are reading news from sources that are essentially just aggregating news content. And so you go to the Drudge Report as an example, or some of these others, the Levine News source some of you may be seeing. They're just stories that are coming. And as you click from site to site, you don't know what the origin of that reporting is. You don't know where it came from. You don't know whose interests were really being served in the reporting of that content. And so we need a kind of media literacy that enables people to critically assess the information that they're receiving. And whether or not that has to do with ownership of the media, I mean, there may be some examples where the hierarchical media organizations and the restructuring of media has increased the number of providers but decreased, in some real sense, the ownership of who's providing a substantial share of that information, may be a cause for concern. You know, starting with the Reagan administration, we relaxed a lot of the rules on broadcast media, for instance, in terms of their a need to serve the public interest, in terms of ownership of newspapers as well as TV stations or multiple TV stations and radio stations across areas. We've got a huge debate that's building now on net neutrality and whether or not Internet service providers can begin structuring news content in ways that could change. And those are issues that we really need to get public debate and discussion and engagement on, because they're going to be critically important to defining the information marketplace in the years to come. We tend to use a marketplace metaphor when talking about information, but we have to recognize that it's not a marketplace where everyone enters the market with equal power. There are buyers and there are sellers. There are providers of information that have a lot more power than the consumers of information. And so we need to be thinking strategically about how you create a marketplace that works to the interests of all the users as well as the producers of content.
I want to thank all of you for being here, and Beverly and Lisa and Tom for sharing some time with us. I want to put in a plug for the next panel, because I think a lot of our desire to understand how new tools allow us to think through this material and to come up with solutions, not to put too much pressure on Lewis and Tara and Siva, but I think that dialogue will continue. And I think it's also really good for us to remember that although this conversation is so often couched in terms of media, that information equals media, and that's critically important. Information also, the only way that it can work is if we are taught at some point how to think through a problem that has to be solved, and that all political information really comes at us as a way to help us achieve what we need to achieve, to put that stop sign on the corner. I think it's an incredibly powerful way of just sort of revitalizing hope, you know, beyond the polarization of party discourse, that really we need to put a stop sign on the corner, you know, and that is common ground, and it's compelling. And our tradition of libraries is just one to be incredibly proud of. If immigrants sometimes know that, maybe better than those of us who were immigrants generations ago. So thank you very much. Thanks for being with us.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.